Coming up today, Imogen Heap will be joining us to talk about all things musical and technological, and due to immensely popular feedback from last week, we're continuing our debate about the benefits of switching off tech. Specifically this week, banning tech entirely from public spaces. Plus, in the news, the UK piracy police arrest a man suspected of running an internet proxy server for accessing illegal sites in the UK, and Google is to rank encrypted websites higher in search results over those who don't protect your user privacy. And is your local fashion mannequin going to start messaging you? The answer might be yes. All that and more, plus an epic sack of your feedback coming up. This is the Wired.co.uk podcast, your weekly guide to the important and interesting from science and tech to mannequin evolution and development in arrests. I'm your host, Nate Langston. I'm the editor of Wired.co.uk.
I'm Olivia underscore Solon.
And I'm Katie Collins.
And LiveAid, Olivia, has some news. And we're going to tell you this exciting news at the end of the show. So regular fans need to stick around to, okay, have a listen.
Sinister.
It isn't that sinister, is it really? Let's be honest. But first, the news.
There's this new unit, or relatively new unit, called the Police Intellectual Property Crime Unit that has been really ramping up efforts to clamp down on piracy lately. There's a big operation called Operation Creative, which you know, might sound like a plan to make lots of lovely pictures, but it's actually to target people who are uploading, hosting illegal content. Now, they've been doing a few different things, and one of them is replacing advertising on sites hosting such illegal content with scary warning banners and skyscrapers saying that, you know, you should not be downloading illegal content. And it's also managed to shut down a few websites also hosting illegal content. But this week, things kind of ramped up a bit with the arrest of a 20-year-old man who was arrested on suspicion of copyright infringement for merely running a proxy server that provided access to 36 other sites which were subject to legal blocking orders.
And that included the Pirate Bay.
Including the Pirate Bay.
The big one. But this server isn't just pointing to, or rather it was just pointing to rather than hosting the content,
yes,
wasn't it? Because it was deliberately circumventing the law.
Exactly. It was providing a means to access these sites that have been blocked by High Court orders in the UK. And it's a company called the Torrenticity Group, and there was a server called Immunicity. And people could, I think there was a, you could just change your browser settings. And it meant that when you were browsing, it would automatically direct you through different web proxies depending on the URL you were trying to access, and it was torrent sites and proxies that it was unblocking. So now when you visit this site, you just kind of see kind of scary looking takedown notice saying that it's been taken down because, and it's under a criminal investigation. And I think it comes down to the fact that Immunicity and these proxies, even though they aren't hosting illegal content per se, they are providing circumvention techniques, and that in itself counts as copyright infringement under UK law.
But I was going to say, I think specifically what's interesting is that this was a man arrested in the UK because he was the one operating the server.
Yeah.
Whether the server was located here is not known as far as I'm aware, like the physical actual server.
Oh, I don't actually know the answer to
that
question.
No, I couldn't find an answer to that, but the fact that he was operating it and running it was what was illegal. But it does call into question, I think, a lot of these sites, either the ones that provide streaming access to television stations and things like that. Proxies obviously being used for a lot of things, sometimes just to get around corporate firewalls or for accessing the internet in China. But this one that specifically targeted BitTorrent at a time when that sort of stuff's being cracked down on from an ISP level, it does seem to be a fairly good way of getting arrested potentially. So
yeah,
that's probably word to the wise there. Meanwhile, in Google has made changes to its search algorithm to give preference to more secure websites. Elgoog will start to highlight pages that have secure HTTPS encryption enabled, which scrambles data, as many people listening probably know already, between your browser and Google's servers. It'll do that by default as part of Google's stated ambition to make the web safer. It's likely, actually, that the move will encourage more websites to start using encryption as they compete for the ever important to Google Juice or SEO ranking or position in the search results, whatever you want to call it. And it turns out that Google's been testing changes to this search algorithm that takes whether sites use secure encrypted connections into account. Lagoog did actually say in a blog post that it's seen positive results as a result of this and is now starting to use HTTPS as a ranking signal. Now, I think for the time being, it's not going to make a massive difference to search rankings, particularly not for popular websites. And Google says that it will carry less weight than signals such as high quality content and things like that that it traditionally uses to rank where a website gets positioned in its results. And it will be giving the companies time to switch over to using HTTPS. But it does give me a couple of points, you know, as an editor of a website that I kind of would like to find answers for from Google once they start doing this more forcefully, is it would give websites a competitive disadvantage to not move into SSL, to not innovate and pay money to enable security. It sort of forces you into saying, well, look, if you want to rank better, then you need to use encryption. And that presents not necessarily problems, but it does present a bit of a decision making quandary that some webmasters, if we still call them that, might have to decide. And I'm not sure whether that's necessarily fair because of the sheer power that Google has to say, well, if you're not encrypting traffic, then you're not getting ranked as highly.
But I mean, webmasters, again, to use that word, have always been sort of trying to second guess what Google's doing and then adapting their websites accordingly. And I think this is just another step. I don't think it's going to make a massive difference, but I guess, you know, in light of all the revelations of mass surveillance and security is very much at the forefront of people's minds at the moment. So having added security on your website is not a bad thing. But I find it a little bit ironic that it's Google who've been given backdoor access to people like the NSA to be now championing security measures.
I mean, Google takes a lot of things into consideration with SEO. I mean, my favorite one that it does is it looks at how long people stay on a website after going to that website from a search result. And if the time spent on that website, what's called dwell time, is really low and goes back to the results, that says to Google, this was the wrong search result for that search term. And if that continues en masse for the same website or the same page, that's good enough to get you not necessarily delisted, but certainly ranked down in Google's estimation, which could mean that if you have a badly designed website or a poor user experience, you're presenting Google with the opportunity of delisting you as a result. That's not very good necessarily.
I think as well, this is quite a straightforward change. So many of the changes that Google's made to its algorithm, people have had to kind of figure out by trial and error themselves, and at least they're kind of being upfront.
Balls and feet. Footballs, they're called. I've heard some of those fly around a place called Old Trafford.
Football isn't necessarily your area of expertise.
No.
But Manchester United have announced this week that they will be banning tablets and laptops from their ground. They've made this decision not, as some news outlets have pointed out, to ban tablet photography. You know, when you see people holding up iPads and blocking everyone else's view of the beautiful game.
That's what I hope it was for.
Yes. But in fact, the reason that Manchester United is starting to get worried about tablets and laptops in their ground is for the same reason that airports have started asking people when they come through security to make sure that their tablets and laptops are fully charged.
Terrorism,
yes. So,
because there's so many people in the ground.
Yes, and because unlike an airport, they don't have airport style security. I'm actually a Manchester United fan, so they are very good.
Okay. Listeners.
I've been to Old Trafford many times and I can say for sure that they definitely don't have any kind of airport style security in place. So rather than attempting to kind of check everybody who comes into the ground and making sure that they've got their laptop or tablet charged and they can turn on, which is the rule when you go through airport security now, they've just said you can't bring them in. So,
wow.
Yeah.
I suppose it makes sense in a sense because, I mean, how many people does Old Trafford hold? 50,000?
76,000.
But the terrorism risk here is the thought that you might have a bomb disguised as a device.
Yeah,
right?
That's right. So the intelligence authorities issued guidance that suggested that you could hide an explosive device within a small portable electronic like a tablet or a laptop.
So they did that for the Olympic stadium, didn't they? Something like that?
Well, they had a security in place, very good security, like airport-style security in place for the Olympics. But this particular rule about the tablets and laptops has only been brought into effect sort of in the last couple of months, basically. So this is a new thing. But it's interesting to see that this is the first time that an events venue of this size has really started to think about this kind of thing. It's almost a bit worrying in a way that...
Can I put my broken Britain hat on for a sec?
Sure.
Is this too far that we're banning devices from football stadiums because we're worried about terrorism? Or is that a sort of overstepping the mark?
Well, I think...
Because I think most terrorist acts in the UK over the last couple of decades haven't necessarily been to do with planes, and we are obsessed with checking planes. How many have been to do with football stadiums or events like that? Because to me, it seems to be like public transport, buses, the tube, obviously, things like that. Not necessarily sports venues.
Public transport has always been a really, really big target. Mm. And in fact, I think only two terrorist attempts or, you know, threats over the last few decades have been, like you say, to do with aviation.
Yeah.
So it does seem like we're kind of skewed towards making sure that, you know, airport security is really, really tight, but yet in other areas of life we don't seem to be putting the kind of same emphasis on the fact that, you know, we could be
I suppose it's easier to police somewhere like that, but it still strikes me as bizarre that one football stadium is being proactive in this sense about tablets, and yet the London Underground, you know, it almost encourages it by having Wi-Fi under there, and that's a place that has a history of activity of terrorism. And I wonder.
I suspect we'll start seeing this happen more and more. I mean, it's interesting because obviously places like schools often have things like metal detectors at the gates.
Yeah, the inner city schools, but that's not for terrorism as much as it is for like knife attacks.
It's not, but the level, you know, there's interesting levels of security and surveillance in schools that we don't necessarily see in other large spaces where there's lots and lots of people. But I guess any place where there are thousands or tens of thousands of people is vulnerable to an attack and is a potential target. So I don't know, I'm not that bothered. I don't think I wouldn't be that concerned about not being able to take my iPad to a football match, but I'd be very interested to hear what other people think about it.
Well, let us know what you think. Do you think this is a step too far? Do you think it's a step taken too late? Should all sports stadiums of this size be subject to such restrictions? Let us know. podcast@wired.co.uk. Well, we're going to just pause the news for a second and have a miniature break in proceedings to speak to Imogen Heap. Now, earlier this week, Katie went up to the Roundhouse in Camden where Imogen was performing, and we thought it was a moment, just the right moment to go and speak to her because we've had her on the show before. We've had her performing with her amazing Connect 3D sound manipulating gloves at our event at Wired 2012, and she's got a new album coming out soon.
So we talked a lot about the gloves, and in my interview I started by asking her about how she actually used them in the recording process for her new album.
I have a pair of gloves. At the moment they are still a way away from really where I need them to be to record fluidly in the studio. But what I have been able to do and can do with them is expressively interact with my computer using software that I know and love, but instead of having to be forced to use a fader or a pot kind of turning something left and right or up and down or adding in a frequency range or whatever I might want to do, instead of doing that with a fader, I can do that with my hands. And so there's this lovely kind of instant access, this intuitive movement that happens when you want to change a parameter of some sort in the flow of things. But as far as recording goes, I mean, there are many wonderful things out there already for recording, and there's lots of things that the gloves are not going to be doing anything better than anything else. But when it comes down to that missing gap, that gap where the human and the machine kind of, you know, are hitting heads because you haven't got something that feels like a flow of a human body that you may want to interact with a certain type of sound in a certain way. It may be very sculptural, the sound that you're making. And to do that with your hands feels much more natural than to try to do that with X, Y, you know, movement up and down or left and right inside your mixer.
What other technologies are out there already that are exciting you particularly?
So there's a perfect opportunity to talk about new technology as part of this festival that's happening this weekend, the weekend of the 21st to 24th, which is the August Bank Holiday weekend. It's a festival called Reverb, and it's showcasing lots of exciting combinations of Arduinos and lights and speakers and ambisonics and light reactive trees kind of reacting through to movement and sound with light and music. It's also using technologies like, there's this guy called Rob Thomas who used to be part of RJDJ, which is how I know him. He makes brilliant apps. And he has created a kind of sonic scape that people can send a message through the listening chair, which is a chair that I've developed with a group of students from the Middlesex University, where you sit in it and you say something. In 15 seconds, it could be, Michael, will you marry me? Or whatever you want to say, whatever secret thing or something confessional or whatever you like. And then the tree will kind of regurgitate this out into the public as they walk in a kind of almost dreamlike, ethereal way.
So I know you've had a lot of fans contribute to your new album.
Yeah, when it comes to fans, I feel like there's an amazing community out there of people, listen to my music or don't listen to my music, who either make films or they're photographers or they're musicians or they are illustrators or whatever it is that their passion is, whether they do it professionally or not. And I like to be able to tap into that and to help, to kind of make something together, whether it's a piece of art or an album or so. Yeah, I've used I pay for people's work as well that I use. So I have crowdsourced photography, crowdsourced videos. I did a crowdsourced animation video for a song called Telemiscommunications, who deadmau5, it was deadmau5, and it was kind of a joint thing. But I like the idea of having a collaborative animated movie, a video. So there's like 20 different animators, and we gave them an outline and a horizon and a colour scheme, and between them they created this really cool video, which we edited, but we gave them these guidelines, and it really works beautifully together. And then I made music out of the recordings from this one particular day on the 9th of December in 2012, with over 24 different scenes across the city of Hangzhou, with 24 sets of people in 24 locations. And the recordings that I made from that day, whether it's the printing press, printing up the newspaper that was talking about the thing on that day, which was also my birthday, and then threading these all into a song. And so it can be, inspiration can come from anywhere. It can come from a fan sitting in the sound of a match, or it can come from a word that somebody has sent in, or it can be a city.
So you've had this Kickstarter campaign going for the gloves. What kind of feedback did you get from that, and what have you learned from it?
I love the model of Kickstarter. I love this, this kind of wave of energy behind people wanting something to happen that couldn't ordinarily have happened. I think it's amazing, and it's changing our world, this crowdfunding kind of system. But unfortunately for us, it didn't work. It didn't work in the sense that we didn't get our final cash, but it did work in the way that it really spread. It spread the word for the gloves. And we did find our top-tier collaborators, which was something that we thought we were going to have problems with because it's £5,000. But actually what we struggled with, and maybe we didn't have the right pledges, was the kind of the lower-level pledges. But we can't offer at the moment gloves for an affordable price right now because they're just expensive beasts. It's taking a lot of time to develop them. And we're only 7... and it's an expensive thing. But anyway, what happened was we did find we found 13 people who have given us this £5,000. And they're not investors, but they're like, they realise that maybe they're paying more, obviously, than they would in a year from now, but they want them now, and they want to get started with us, and they want to collaborate on the process and work with us on the software and the hardware. And we're really excited because at the moment it's just me testing it. And I'm pretty busy at the moment, and now I'm pregnant, so I'm going to be extra busy. Hopefully we'll find a solution for something a bit more affordable that, people wouldn't maybe think twice about as a way to interact with their software and make music on the move.
So in terms of these collaborators, is there anything particularly unusual or interesting they're working on?
There's a guy called Klemchak who makes music with avocados. So he makes music while he's cooking, and that's an interesting one. So he was asking us if he could have a waterproof pair of gloves, and we can't really do that, so we suggested that maybe he could just put some marigolds over the top of it for now. But they don't mind getting a bit wet, as I discovered as I poured some tea over them the other day. And another lady, she's a girl from Cambridge. Well, she lives in Cambridge, but she's from the States. She's from the US Air Force, and she's a captain. And she's interested in using the gloves for storytelling.
So your new album's about to come out. What's next in the pipeline?
A lot of things are leading towards this big occasion, which is this fantastic festival that is happening on August Bank Holiday weekend here in London at the Roundhouse in Camden. And it's a celebration of music and technology, two things very close to my heart, and people, how people can play with these things. So the public can come in and strap themselves to the building with Di Maidstone's Human Harp. They can go into the hub of the building and into the basement, and they can see the speed of sound with light. And they can come into the main room, which is something I'm about to see now, with the arboreal lightning, which is a sound and movement reactive tree, which responds in light and music, generative and reactive music, using the samples of your voice. So I'm very excited to be. I'm the curator, so I'm kind of responsible for all of that. And the lights just suddenly went out in our room.
Peter Collins there speaking to Imogen Heap. And if you want to have a look at the gloves in action, do go to wired.co.uk and search for Imogen Heap, and you will find our video from Wired 2012, or it's on YouTube as well, of her performing at our event.
Oh, and don't forget, the album is out on Monday the 18th of August.
In fact, one of my photos of hers in her new box set, actually. Oh, very excited.
We should all buy it then.
Back to our news rundown before we get into the second half of our show today. And a police chief has called for direct access to your medical records. Yours, Liv. Yours, Katie. Probably mine.
Yeah.
What the dealio?
So if you've been listening to the podcast for a while, which I hope you have. Well, I know you have.
Yeah.
You'll have heard quite a few discussions about care.data, which is the government initiative to centralise patient data, which is currently stored within GPs. Now, the idea is about improving healthcare, and under the scheme, which hasn't launched yet due to lots of controversy, police will be able to, with a warrant, gain access to a patient's data without actually asking the GP, which might sound okay. But now, one very prominent police chief is asking for additional powers to access patient medical records without an individual's consent and without a warrant. This is from comments made by Greater Manchester Chief Constable Sir Peter Fahey, I think is how you say his name. I might have got that wrong. About protecting vulnerable people. And it's meant to be about accessing the records, supposedly, of people with things like dementia, with a history of drug and alcohol abuse, mental health problems, or victims of domestic violence. And according to Sir Peter, these people account for around 70% of police work.
Wow.
So what he wants to happen is allow police to access GP and social records in order to either obtain data out of hours. What he wants to happen is to allow police to access GP and social records to either obtain data out of hours, or kind of find data information that will protect them or the police trying to deal with them without a warrant. So, for example, he suggested being able to look at records before even responding to a call that relates to a patient. So perhaps, you know, finding out what someone's history with drug abuse is.
Now, something that interested me was he went further than that, I think, and suggested that doctors should be able to compel to share records of victims of domestic violence, even if the patient has refused. So it's not even just without a warrant, that's actually going against what they asked for.
Yeah, it's extraordinary. But then there is a kind of slightly similar initiative, and it's not the same, it is more extreme, which has been in agreement between the British Medical Association and the police, which is about doctors being compelled to share data relating to people who own guns and show and are showing signs of a mental illness or distress that might potentially lead to a violent attack using the gun. If GPs suspect that that might happen, there was an agreement made that means that they now bypass their commitment to confidentiality, to patient confidentiality, and pass that data on. But this goes a lot further, and it extends to a much, much wider portion of society. And I think given that there's quite a lot of public concern about the centralisation of patient data through care.data, it's kind of yet another worrying erosion of privacy of medical records. But this is just the comments of one man, one powerful man within the police, but it turns out that the British Medical Association doesn't think these extended powers are a good idea. They've said that the current checks and balances, which, you know, include having to gain a warrant to access patient records, are satisfactory. So hopefully this won't happen, but I think, you know, when this data is centralised, it will be much easier to do these sorts of searches. And so if these powers are extended, it's going to be an even more kind of worrying on one hand and powerful on the other hand resource.
Well, you sort of became the country's expert on the care.data debacle, which we published stories on extensively. What's your opinion of this? Do you think the British Medical Association is correct, or do you think this is actually a good thing? Speaking personally, obviously.
Personally, I wouldn't want to live in a world where police have unfettered access to everyone's medical records. You know, they might say it's about vulnerable people, but I think, how do you categorise someone who's vulnerable? You know, unless that was very, very, very tightly managed, I'd be very concerned about this.
I'm on your side there, I have to say. What about you, Katie?
Yeah, no, I think the warrant system exists for a reason, and I can understand why, you know, it might be difficult because policing is a round-the-clock job, and there might be something that they could do to speed up the process, or, you know, and they perhaps do need to renegotiate how they help and deal with people who might have mental illnesses or addictions or, you know, that kind of thing.
Police are increasingly squeezed for resources, and as I said, 70% of cases involve these sorts of people they're trying to get the data of. And I can see a few cases where, you know, you might have someone come into custody at 3 a.m. and you can't get a warrant until 9 a.m. or whatever time the warrant process starts. But I feel as though if someone's really that vulnerable, for example, someone with dementia who doesn't know who they are and you need to find a next of kin, they're, you know, probably more low-tech solutions like bracelets, etc., for those people, as opposed to giving police access to medical records.
Well, let us know what you think. podcast@wired.co.uk. Do you think that having a warrant-free, unfettered tunnel to your medical records is fine for police to have, or do you think that that would give them unreasonable access to your medical history? Let us know. podcast@wired.co.uk. The last item on our news agenda today, it is that 3 major UK stores have become the first to trial mannequins embedded with beacon technology, designed to give nearby customers relevant information on their phones. Basically, smart models. That's what we're talking about here. The shops participating in this initial implementation are House of Fraser's online store, Hawes and Curtis in London's Jermyn Street, and Bentalls in Kingston upon Thames. And unlike other perhaps more intrusive forms of mannequin surveillance, which we've written about in the past, such as the ones where their fake dead plastic eyes were in fact cameras tracking your age and your sex, this system is from a provider called Iconmere. Is it Iconmere? Liv, you wrote this story. I don't know how to pronounce this company. Iconmere? We're not sure, are we?
I didn't write the story, but Iconmere.
This company that we can't pronounce relies on customers downloading an app and opting in exchange for services rather than being tracked by cold automatons posing as mannequins. Now, each of these mannequins are uploaded with data decided upon by the store in question so that when a customer nears it, the app fills with relevant information about the clothes on display with prices and links to purchase online. Now, this raises two questions. Question the first. First, why does it need to be in a mannequin? Can it not just be in any stand that is near these clothes? Question number two, would this not be better if the mannequins were sort of, not automatons, but animatronic? So they can sort of raise a hand and say, you there, do you like my sexy skirt? Because you can get it for 25% off for downloading our app. I think that would be A, scary, but B, brilliant.
I just think this is another example of marketers completely misunderstanding what people want. No one has ever said, oh, I wish I could get more push notifications to my mobile phone from mannequins in store. I can see the value in tracking.
Haven't they?
I can see the
Somebody
value in tracking
has.
People coming into the store, but passively. But seriously, do we need this?
Do we need this indeed? I do wonder whether this is a bit of a PR stunt on the one hand. But on the other hand, I don't know. Mannequins are, I suppose, a little bit more specific than a rail. I've been in some clothes shops and they do tend to have a lot of styles very, very close together. Mm. With a mannequin, at least, it generally is probably a little bit easier to target. But you're talking about a 50-meter radius, I think, or 50-foot radius for this. That's quite a lot of mannequins in some of these clothes shops. I've heard about.
Yeah, so my first thought about this is, firstly, it's only in 3 shops, so there's not really much incentive for anybody to download the app at the moment, unless it's like in every shop along a high street that you go to. No one's going to want that. Second thought is, mannequins really freak me out anyway.
Have you seen the ones in M&S? Scary looking children with
they're
the, like,
all terrifying.
Spines rotated and it's like screaming eyes. And then there's the other one for, oh, name a gents' clothes shop that does clothes. Not Burton, but one like that.
Zara.
Officers Club, is that one?
Yes, that is
River
one.
Island?
Officers Club.
One of those. They have the sternest looking mannequins ever. They look like they're posing for some sort of prostate exam while standing up. They are the most frightening looking mannequins I've seen, probably arguably more so than the children in M&S.
Well, the problem that I always have with mannequins is that it doesn't really matter exactly what they look like. If I can sense a figure there behind me, I will regularly think that mannequins around me in a shop are actual people, and that they are watching me anyway. I'd feel like I'm being watched just when there's a figure standing still, like in my peripheral vision.
To be honest, in the UK, you're being watched all that time
I know, but it's
by men sitting down eating hobnobs with the trousers down, possibly, for all you know, and that's terrifying. And on that note, we have to take a very quick break, but don't go anywhere, because when we come back, should device banning be commonplace in public spaces? Not for terrorism, but for the benefit of humanity. Stay with us.
Do you want a free audiobook? You probably do, since you're listening to our podcast. Audible.co.uk is offering every listener of the Wired.co.uk podcast any book from its catalogue of 80,000, including the latest science, technology and business releases from best-selling authors, just for trying out its service. A one-month trial of audible.co.uk costs nothing, and whatever book you choose to download is yours to keep, even if you cancel your account. Head to audible.co.uk/wired, where you can sign up in a few seconds to download any book you want. You'll be supporting Nate, Olivia, Liat, and the rest of the wired.co.uk podcast team, and you get a free book in return. Sign up easily now at audible.co.uk/wired. Thanks for supporting the show. That's audible.co.uk/wired.
Welcome back. We have one discussion segment to get to before we get to our feedback loop. And to continue last week's discussion, which was branded under Made in the UK, we'll call this again Made in the UK. And that is also an excuse to use that music in the background, because I'm a big fan of this little tune here. But we had loads of feedback about the discussion we had last week, which was about the park in Britain that is asking people, or rather suggesting, they might want to deposit their electronic devices before they get into the park in order to have a more communal experience with nature and be undistracted by notifications of push and various things like that. And we did get so much feedback that we thought, why don't we continue this debate a little bit, because we had that discussion earlier in the show about Old Trafford banning technology, or banning tablets for reasons of terrorism, and thinking, well, actually, what if, kind of how in the 90s and before it became illegal to smoke indoors, we had smoke-free zones, well, we had smoking areas, what if we had electronics areas? On trains, you can get these quiet carriages, which I know a lot of people, my mother included, always books, because that's the one where people are more respectful of people's...
They're never quiet enough.
Never quiet enough. And certainly in gigs, there's conversations that, you know, holding tablets up is incredibly antisocial. It blocks views from behind. Mm. Is there a compelling argument to ban tech in public areas?
Sort of make it the opposite of a Faraday cage.
Yes, in a sense. Well, yeah, I mean, you are...
Like, make areas that are the opposite of a Faraday cage. Like, where you can go in, like, here is the tech area.
Yes. When I visited the Queen, she had the only area of the place in the palace you're allowed to tweet from was called the Tweet Suite.
I like that. That's nice.
I like that as well. And I know I think we wrote about a Faraday cafe, which was designed in a Faraday cage way so that you couldn't get any connectivity in there. But I like the idea. I think you last week talked about going for dinner without your device. I think I'd feel uncomfortable arranging the meeting time without my device, but I'm not averse to the idea of getting to a restaurant and then putting your phone in a little locker, as you do if you ever go to number 10. But I think that's a nice
forest.
Idea.
The new forest front we talked about last week. I agree. I mean, I'm a big advocate now of device-free stuff. I did it just last night. I had dinner and somebody went to the bathroom and I didn't pull out my phone that was in my bag recharging. I just left it there and just looked around. It's like, no, don't need to check this. This is my moment to not be distracted by work emails and push notifications and run quickly. It's on fire. Like, that can wait. There's enough people to put out fires.
Yeah, I think this is all really a question of etiquette for the 21st century. And we probably just haven't really settled on a set of rules that people can agree on yet.
Techiquette. Let's call it that.
And perhaps this is something that we should be thinking about a bit more and taking a bit more seriously. But
On that note, there's, you know, similar etiquette needs to develop around how people behave with each other online. But that's a sort of sub note to this topic.
But all of these breaks, either whether it's in restaurants, whether it's walks, I always sort of find it fascinating how a lot of people, and I've noticed this a lot in lifts and when waiting to get their lunch from a sandwich place or something at lunchtime, is the lift. For goodness sake, don't stand in a lift silent with somebody. Quick, pull your phone out. Look at anything. Yeah. Doesn't matter what it is. Flick through home screens, see if you've got a missed call, maybe load up email. And I know that what they're doing is not important because as soon as the lift door opens, phone goes back in the pocket.
Yeah. It's
just social awkwardness. It doesn't need to happen.
With lifts, I've actually made a conscious decision to not do that because I feel as though whenever someone gets in and they start doing that, I kind of see that as you say, awkwardness and as a point of character weakness.
Yeah.
And so I've now, even though I do feel awkward, I've stopped doing it because I think it is just rude. And I now try to say hi, you know, even if it's just hi, good morning, to people. But and I have the same thing when I'm left alone in a restaurant. It feels really awkward not getting my phone out, but I've tried to like enforce breaks from doing that.
Leave that digital syringe on the floor.
Yeah.
Go cold turkey.
Also, when it's the other way around and you're the person that's nipped to the loo and is coming back, it'd be much nicer to be greeted by somebody who's waiting for you, ready to greet you and smile at you, rather than somebody who you then have to drag away from whatever they were looking at on their phone.
Especially in dating circumstances, you don't want to think that someone's tweeting or, you know, writing that email to their friend, even though that's all they want to do.
Let us know what you think. You know, could you see more places where phones are strongly encouraged to be disabled, to be turned off, to be put away, where there's some sort of stigma? If you pull it out, it's kind of like when you pull out a phone in class and you get told off. At least that's what always used to happen to me when I worked in a school. I was the one telling off, by the way.
It sounds a little bit like my parents' dining table when I go and visit them. It's even if the house phone rings, nobody answers it. Nobody gets up. We just pretend it's not happening.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah.
I wish my brother was like that. Sometimes I'm in mid-conversation and just eyes, I just sort of see his eyeballs very slowly move down to the screen.
Yeah.
And I'm like, dude, I'm talking. Carry on. It's like some sort of weird habit.
Made even worse by the wearables.
Oh, good Lord. Well, let us know what you think to that. Are you my brother? Or you just got opinion about whether quiet carriages should come into all of our public spaces? podcast@wired.co.uk. And on that topic, we're going to move straight into the feedback loop. Now, we've got a lot of feedback, and we're going to start by going through some of the thoughts that you had from last week's discussion about tech-free environments and things like that. We're going to start with someone I think who's written in before, because I remember not being able to pronounce this name confidently before. It's either Answer or Anchor. Let us know. Is it a K? Is it a C? Phonetics, please, people. And Anchor says, "Hey, Wired Podcast team, a lovely podcast as usual. Really enjoy your talk about the tech detox. I'm not as bad as I used to be a few years ago, but I just wanted to share what I used to do at the worst point in my tech addiction. I used to do this with a friend of mine. It needs to be someone you really trust to make sure it doesn't go wrong. We used to swap passwords to our Facebook account, and then we would have to change each other's passwords so we could no longer have access to our profiles. We would set a deadline, normally a week, and then exchange passwords again. That way, we couldn't go on our profile even if we wanted to, and I have to say, it felt really good. Obviously, it only works with social profiles, not devices, but try it for yourselves and see. Keep up the good work. I absolutely agree. I think that is a very interesting idea, and I think in a sense it could work with phones. There are, particularly if you're on Android, or you could do like remote unlocking. You could possibly do that. Mm. Marty's written in, hasn't he, Liv?
Yes, and he said, I love the show and all of your soothing voices, even with Nate back.
Woo.
I think he's got the most soothing of all the voices.
It's definitely the deepest.
Thank you very much, Liv.
And he said, I was listening this morning to cheer myself up during a rainy commute and found the section on therapy through de-techifying yourself pretty interesting. Once I reached my desk, the first email that popped up was a weekly briefing from Deloitte, which I subscribed to, this week discussing perceived versus actual working hours of people today. And it's an interesting read on its own, but check out the extract below. So across the rich world, people are working less and have more leisure time. So why do so many of us feel so hassled and stressed? Paradoxically, prosperity may be the problem. US economists Mark Aguirre and Eric Hurst argue that we are squeezing even more activities, both work and leisure, into our day. Technology, prosperity, and organizational change have made us busier and more hassled. Just consider the number of individual emails you write and respond to every day, the number of texts you send and receive, the number of occasions you glance at your news or sports results online. The ubiquity of mobile communications means that people are rarely disconnected. Marty continues, I thought you'd be interested to note that you were a day ahead of Deloitte's chief economist in discussing the key topics of today. Great minds and all that.
Very interesting observations. I agree. I really like that. That thing though about perceived versus actual working hours.
Yeah.
Maybe on contracts of the future, you'll say you're contracted 7 hours per day plus 3 hours in total of email checking.
I remember doing a marking of GCSE Spanish papers once after I finished uni, and they had this great online system where you got paid by the hour, but it was only hours when you were on the tab where the marking was. And if you deviated from the tab, the clock would stop. And if you were inactive on that tab for more than, I think it was something ridiculous, like 1 minute, you were it would stop as well.
Wow.
And it was quite brutal, actually. I put in so many extra hours at my computer, but just didn't actually do that much work.
We'll start
time.
Calling that micro-employment in the future. You've got your employment hours and your micro-employment hours. Let's see if that takes off. Colin has written in, hasn't he, Katie?
He has. He says, I often try to make moments when I purposefully don't check my phone or resist using it to fill the smallest moments of time, especially since you reported that study that men would rather suffer an electric shock themselves than do nothing. That was a few podcasts back. I also sometimes try to leave it when I go places, but I have to admit it feels so odd when I don't have my phone on me, like something is missing. It concerns me that I am so psychologically attached, but at the same time, I don't really mind that I am, and I don't know which of those facts is most disconcerting. Anyway, I've rambled enough. Keep up the good work, and nice to be hearing Nate again.
Thanks very much. It's nice to hear from you, Colin. That's a really interesting point. I think that feeling that you've left something behind is incredibly powerful, and certainly I definitely feel that. My thing is just turning off notifications and creating points in the day where I'm not checking updates and things. That's kind of it. But that feeling of, oh God, no, I've left my phone.
Yeah,
where's
yeah.
my phone? Like that panic for me feels sometimes worse than, did I leave my wallet at my desk?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or where are my glasses? Oh, they're on the top of my head.
Yeah, that happens. We've got a couple more that's on this topic. Vicky says, I'm currently on holiday in Madeira with my family, and I was intrigued by your discussion about when off should be off. In the hotel we are in, there is only Wi-Fi in bar and cafe areas. I have a feeling Vicky might be channeling our previous discussion about areas that have electric access and things. This has ended up with coffee and mealtimes becoming iPad sessions, with us all staring at our tablets, checking various social media sites and our emails. This has meant an old traditional family time has stopped being sociable. If you look across the cafe's bars, you see this replicated across other families. I can't decide whether this is an argument for turning off technology more or whether it's an argument for more Wi-Fi coverage. Very compelling point.
Leave them in the hotel safe, is
yes,
what I say.
Your family, that is, and take the iPad on your own. And Alan, do you want to take the last one from Liv?
Yes.
No, the other way around. Liv from
yeah.
Alan.
Alan from Texas wrote in to say he listened to last week's episode while on the way to go bird watching. And he said, the feature about the program to check tech devices at the forest door struck a chord with me. But the chord it struck was not the Luddite abandon all tech to have a real experience chord. I'm grateful to have a handheld computer disguised as a phone at the ready when I birdwatch. I can confirm a species identification. I can get directions or a map. I can look up a place to eat.
Could eat a bird.
He could eat a bird. I'm not sure. Some of them might be protected. I think if there is a cautionary tale, it is one about wasting a handheld computer on social media. But even those contacts make the world a less lonely place. I'm in my 50s and can turn off technology without qualms or pain. But my smartphone does not detract from my hiking any more than the bicycle, despite Luddite protests, ruined walking.
I think that's quite an interesting point, actually, just because I personally often turn my phone onto aeroplane mode when I'm on holiday, and just so I can still use the camera, but I'm not wasting any extra battery or using it for anything else.
I actually turn the do not disturb feature on when I have my park lunches at the office here. Rather than disabling the ability to receive calls if it was urgent, I put on they do not disturb, so notifications don't come through, but I can still stream something from iPlayer, for example. And that seems to be a good balance of still being able to use the phone and access things, but it's not actually pinging notifications at you while you're looking at a screen. That seems to be a nice compromise. Well, we got a lot more feedback from people, but we've had so much to talk about on this week's show and with Imogen as well, that we're going to put that feedback portion into next week's show. But do still keep it coming at podcast@wired.co.uk, particularly if you've got any continued thoughts on the tech switching off thing, which is its official name, or techiquette, or lift things, and we will get to those as well next week, and possibly even push some more into the third week. Who knows? It's so exciting. And we have one bit of announcement to make, don't we, Liv?
We do.
Liv is going to ruin everyone's life now.
Well, no, not some people who find my voice irritating will be very pleased to hear that I am actually leaving Wired and therefore the Wired.co.uk podcast, which is sad, Wang.
Boo.
It is very sad. Liv is moving on to bigger, greater, exciting things after, I think, 4 years?
Four years.
You've been on every podcast that we've ever done, pretty much, I think.
Apart from the odd holiday here.
The odd holiday here and there, yeah. Well, we are going to miss thee, I think.
I'm
going
to really, really miss it. This is one of the highlights of my week.
And it's mine too. And I tell you something, when I've not been on the podcast, when you were doing it for a few weeks, that became the thing that I enjoyed listening to a lot, because it was suddenly something I could enjoy rather than, well, I do enjoy this, but I wasn't doing the actual recording. It was just getting to hear the recording back, which was nice. But you'll keep listening, won't you?
Absolutely.
You're going to write in?
I'm going to start writing in.
I think that'd be great. We'll have you as a virtual correspondent on various topics.
It'll be weird having my words read out by one of your voices.
Yes. Yeah, it will actually. So further details, I'm sure Liv will keep you guys posted on her Twitter as to what's happening next, which does, of course, mean that myself, Liat and Katie will be your regular trio of podcasters. Obviously, you're familiar with that lineup on many episodes anyway, but that's what's happening. Liv's last episode next week.
Yes.
So podcast@wired.co.uk is where you can send any of your favourite live moments or any questions or any well wishes.
Or good riddance.
Or good riddance. Get out of here and take your dog. Don't take the dog. Please leave the dog here.
Please stop talking about lady bits.
Yes. Well, I'm sure that won't happen very much anyway. But that's going to do it for this week. And we will be back with you next week for Liv's final show. I'm sure there may be some treats I can find in the archive to put in that episode. But until then, have a lovely week.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
You've finished this week's episode of the Wired.co.uk podcast. Until next week's episode, why not download the latest issue of Wired on your iPad, Android tablet or Kindle Fire? Do so with a discount from wired.co.uk/magazine.